in terms of
Did that wrong the first time.
early intervention with students. Another thing that happened this summer, we had many more schools doing various engagement opportunities, again, focused on student retention. So things like hosting play dates on the playgrounds, we did movie nights, we did like ice cream social nights, things of that nature happened throughout the summer.
Well, just real quick, I mean, do we know, there anything concrete that we can point to that led to the increased retention?
I think a few things. One, we made, and for our teachers in particular, we made another large adjustment to our salary scale. I think that certainly helped. Michelle, what were some of the other things that you were looking at today or the last few days that you noticed in terms of trends with the teacher retention and things that you think helped with that?
So there were a number of things that we focused on in this past cycle that impacted retention for this summer. An easy one to notice is the review of the teacher pay scale. It improved significantly, and it was a decision point for many teachers. But in addition to that, there are many things that started before that were in place last year and people who are starting to reap the benefits of that, including additional focus on coaching, observations, and professional development. And we've heard from team members, teachers, and others that they'd like more energy spent on clarifying goals, roles, and responsibilities. We've heard that loud and clear. And this year we have an initiative to create job scorecards for every role in the organization. It will take us 3 years, but we have started this year with a number of key roles where that was a big pain point. And the early feedback that we've received so far in the people who are in job scorecard roles is that they find it incredibly helpful and it helps them align to and feel energized about the direction that we're going as an organization, and they see how their work contributes to it. So all of those things in aggregate are yielding results.
So I know we've talked about this before, but I just don't remember the details. For the folks who are not coming back, are there exit interviews trying to get information? And if so, what kind of information have you
Good question.
gathered?
Yes, we conduct exit surveys. With everyone is offered the opportunity to complete an exit survey. If the team member requests, they can also have an exit interview with a member of the HR team. Very few people request that interview, but when they do, we gather all the notes. We are in the process of finalizing, reviewing all those insights. All of it is open-ended, as you can imagine. We're reviewing all of those insights on the aggregate and also by location. And we'll have that information shortly.
So on top of the survey, there's also an opportunity to speak
That's right.
one-on-one. Okay,
Yes.
great. Thank you.
The last thing I want to mention is just our professional development over the summer. We made quite a few changes, again, based on team member feedback, putting more structure around the professional development and trying to make it more aligned across schools. Because there are like one or two of the
on that, a couple of things came out very clearly. One was that teachers were asking for more collaborative time together, and they asked for more time planning together. as well as opportunities to be in each other's classroom. So I think one of the most important big shifts we made was instead of just doing lesson planning for the first few weeks of the year at their school sites, that we were actually able to do it all together regionally. So for example, you know, every sixth grade math teacher was in a room together talking through unit one of sixth grade math together. We've gotten some pretty positive feedback on that experience. In fact, if anything, we're asking for more, figure out how to do that still. So I think that was a very key move. And then, Amber, I don't know if you want to talk about school leader PD rehearsal, I think is the other big one.
Yes, something we put into place this year was that school leaders prepare key professional developments they would be presenting in front of their staff for each of our big rocks, and they rehearsed and practiced them with either their DOS, or in some situations we had the DOS plus a group of school leaders together practicing. And I think that practice led to stronger implementation, which then led to stronger internalization from the team members. And we're seeing stronger execution.
Sorry, what's the DOS?
Oh, sorry, directors of schools. The people who man, sorry, the team that manages the school leaders.
Thank you. And I already mentioned Starstruck. So I'm going to turn now to our focus, or sharing a little bit about what's happening related to some of our priorities for this year. So you guys have seen this chart a handful of times before, but we're in what we're considering year two of our multi-year plan here to improve our academic outcomes coming out of COVID. As part of this, I think showed this in the last meeting. We've got our three big rocks or three key priority areas for the year. I'm going to touch a bit on what's happened at the start of the year related to Big Rock 1 and Big Rock 2. See Big Rock 1, again, it's create and maintain an anti-racist learning environment. A few of the central areas under that were efforts to improve enrollment and attendance, as well as implement proactive behavior intervention systems. We'll touch on how we're doing with those areas. And then the focus of Big Rock 2 is improving the quality of teaching. And in a bit, Kavika will speak a bit to what's been happening with regard to that. So the first part under Big Rock 1 is enrollment. We can, in fact, students without having them show up to school. And we've had some, improvement to make in that compared to last year. So this chart just shows you where we are overall with enrollment compared to last year. Couple things to note. Fiscal year 24, that includes the three enrollments at the three schools that have closed. Obviously fiscal year 25 does not include those schools. So while we've had a drop in enrollment on a school by school basis or adjusted for those closing schools, we actually have improved by a few hundred students. And this is illustrated as you remember last year in the winter time when we had the meetings discussing the school closures, we were talking about the gap in where our actual enrollment was versus the number of seats that those schools could offer. And the gap between the blue line and the columns here shows our basically vacant seats today. And so you'll see that while our enrollment has gone down, our schools are, have a greater percentage of their seats filled this year. And you can see that through the much narrower gap between our potential seats and the number of seats we have fully enrolled. So that's was something we wanted to see coming into this year. And it's, while we'd like to have that gap closed entirely, it's nice to see it moving in the correct direction. The green column here is what our enrollment in our budget was assumed to be. And then the column on the right was our target for norm day. And so most of what I show you is going to be relative to what our norm day target was. That was the enrollment that all of our schools were working towards. We've built the budget on a slightly more conservative number. And so that's why that's lower. But relative to our, what the reason I want to show this is because relative to our budget, we're actually exceeding our budget in enrollment by a little over 100 students. So from that perspective, budget, you know, we should be in relatively good shape to what we budgeted. To the targets we've been working towards outside of our budget, we're about 340 kids shy of what the targets we set out to meet. And you'll be able to see that by school in a minute. So,
can you remind me again the difference between the target and the budget? I'm just forgetting what the target numbers were.
Yeah. So the target number is the number that we set out in the fall of last year for the accumulation of each school's target. So, you know, X school, you're supposed to have 500 students, another, you know, 450. We didn't adjust that throughout the whole enrollment cycle. We kept those targets constant, even if we saw in, you know, May that they were off track. The budget number was, you know, when we got to the point of finalizing the budget in May, we tried to make the budget based on what we actually were seeing.
Okay,
you know,
so if we, that's accurate.
Yeah, so if we saw a school was, you know, going to be 40 kids off, we built the budget based on that discount of 40 kids.
Okay.
But we've continued to still hit the original target. Does that make sense?
Yep,
that's it.
Thanks.
And so the rest of these charts are going to be compared to our original norm day target, because I do think that's what we should be measuring right. ourselves against. So this is for our elementary schools or our lower schools. You'll see the first set of schools through Empower really right on track with the targets that we set. And then Ignite, Promesa, and Endeavor all are below the targets. I'll show you where they were compared to last year, and you will see that despite this, Promesa has made some really nice enrollment recovery this year, even though they didn't get quite to where our target was. And then for middle schools, a little bit more off our targets, but the first set through Opportunity, either at target or quite close to it. And then Philosopher, Adelante, and Compton were the outliers in terms of being still well below what we had set out to reach. The one thing that you're not seeing here, because we're just showing this in aggregate, Innovation, Soul, Opportunity in particular, their fifth grade enrollment was lower than what it's been in the last few years. And so that's something that as we head into this next recruiting cycle, we're really going to be focused on.
Which school was it?
Oh, Innovation, Soul, Opportunity, and to some extent, Corazon, actually, the KCA. Mm-hmm. And so there's various reasons for that. But in particular, East LA and Southeast LA schools, we put a lot of targeted marketing and advertising towards those schools because we just historically they've not been trouble. They've not been areas where we've struggled to enroll. So as we're creating our plan for next year, our marketing plan, we've allocated quite a bit, I think like $75,000 additional dollars, just focusing on fifth grade at those schools. So we're going to try to get ahead of that this cycle. And also some things like at Seoul, we had much better teacher retention at the end of this year than last year, much fewer vacancies to start the school year compared to last year. So I think some of those things will start to change the tide. And then this just shows you year-on-year enrollment. So the yellow is last year's enrollment. This year's enrollment, or excuse me, blue is this year's enrollment. Yes.
On the ones where we missed for fifth grade, you know, I mean, I know we've talked about how fifth grade is a hard year to recruit for a lot because it's not a transition year, but sixth grade is for a lot of them. Do we try and double down in those cases to?
Yeah, so we call it backfilling, but we are every seat that is not, you know, maybe wasn't filled that prior year, we would definitely try to fill it the new year. And all of
part of the marketing decked against that too, like, because that, you know, if people don't think that that's usually an option in sixth grade, you know, it's kind of, we have to get the word out.
Well, we often our advertising will say now enrolling, and we'll say like grades 5 through 8. So we try to make that, you know, clear in our student recruitment. And in most, if not all of those schools I mentioned, their sixth grades are fully enrolled or over enrolled. So we've been able to make up a little bit for it by over enrolling on the margin, 6th, 7th, 8th grade. But yes, definitely. That being said, we don't rely on that. So we need to reverse that. And then for MESA, you can see there, they've added about 60 kids this year. So again, you saw they're off, that we've set even more ambitious targets. But it is encouraging to see them start their path to enrollment recovery this year. And then RISIS, their enrollment is so elevated, and Illuminar partly was through absorbing some of the kids from Poder and Pueblo Unido when those schools closed. RISIS in particular really expanded their enrollment in an effort to accommodate as many of those kids as we. And then the middle schools, again, you kind of see that series of schools, Innovation, Corazon, Seoul, KO. The reason why they're marginally under what our target is primarily attributed to the fifth grade. And then really the thing we're most excited about is Scholar. If you see there, they've added about 130 kids. And so they really have... started the path to getting up to full enrollment, this being their first full year in their new facility. And, you know, I think it's a combination of marketing efforts, school, Tommy, the school leader, really focused on enrollment, student recruitment. I think they've made good inroads in the new, they're in a slightly new community from where the school was before. So starting to make inroads there and see some excitement in that. So we're very encouraged by that.
And the jump, is it Comienza at the end or?
That's Compton Upper School. So they added another grade level. So they went from one grade level to two, which is primarily attributed. They're still about 40 to 50 kids shy of where, you know, we want them to be at this point with two grade levels. But you can see them growing 120 kids. They did make up a little bit of ground from last year.
Great.
And then, so the second part of the Big Rock One is attendance. And we've been putting a lot of emphasis on trying to improve our attendance over years past. That's, you know, a key part of our being able to improve academically is getting kids in school every day. So year to date, we've shown a little bit of improvement. To be honest, it's not quite as much as I had hoped to see. But you can see here, this is just through this point in the school year compared to last year. We're about a point higher than where we were last year. So it's, again, it's improvement. I would have been happier if this was at 95 or 96 at this point. But it's moving in the right direction.
How are we in comparison to LA Unified?
LA Unified, I looked at their dashboard the last couple of weeks, but they were around 95 the last time I looked.
They're actually higher.
They're higher with what they're reporting. Yeah.
That's accurate.
That's across every school.
Yeah, I would imagine in half neighborhoods, it's probably.
I assume there's some variability in, you know, schools. Neighborhood, they got online learning. You know, they got a huge mix of stuff. But nonetheless, I'll be honest, it frustrates me that we're lagging behind. We're lagging behind the state average. Like we have still room to grow.
I mean, I think we need to look at peer groups, right? That's, state average incorporates a lot of districts and stuff and schools that are not really comps for us, I think. But I do think, I mean, we talked a little bit about the end of last year, you know, kind of reaching, really trying to educate families that if they don't come to school, it means programs that they care about are at risk. Like, have we been kind of trying to explain to them? Like, because I don't think most people realize that. I don't know if somebody hit the school doesn't get money, that means we don't get our.
I don't think we've hit that message as explicitly as that.
Obviously, we don't want to like terrify them and have them sending sick kids to school, but.
It's a good question. I think the answer is no. We've been more focused on, I think, other reasons why, you know, encourage them. I mean, missing out on learning, missing out on social experiences, missing out on the camaraderie more than that at this point.
You mentioned it, I don't know, Andrew or Kevin Bell and Shaw, that LA Unify has online learning. Is this for primary or for elementary school? Do you know?
There are definitely some middle through high school options for it. I have to check on the elementary school, but that's not something that we are authorized to do.
Right.
Like, that's not our charter. But yes, they do have some options that continued after the COVID era. Yeah.
So more middle school?
And high school. But yes. But you're right. Their attendance would get counted.
Right. And if a family...
They're reporting K-12, right?
Right. If family doesn't want to come back, it affects us. They can... Those numbers would be to the benefit of LA Unify because they're considering online.
Sorry.
We had a little bit of that in that first year back. Anecdotally, I haven't heard it since then, but that first year back, it certainly did.
How is ADA calculated in terms of, like, what time of day does it count as their present? Like, if they come in half day late or half day early?
It counts.
Yeah, but
what... Or 10?
No, it's actually, I think Bertha told me 8:30. Yeah, as long as they stay till 8:30.
Reconciled. They go through a process of reconciling later in the day.
So I think they're right now starting.
Okay, so somebody shows up late or misses the first couple hours of school, they'll get counted eventually?
Within a couple of days, yeah.
Yeah.
So here you can just, I won't belabor this, but you can see by school. So this is lower schools. On the high end, we're about 95%. In the low end, 90%. And the yellow, again, is last year. Blue is this year. You see, in most cases, we've made some improvement. I'll also show you in a minute just the absolute attendance, so not on a percent, but the number of kids showing up. And that actually is looking even more favorable. Middle schools, similar amount of variability. A little bit higher on average, but again, almost up to 96% at LA Prep, down to 91% on the low end, their philosophers. And so what I showed you just a minute ago is attendance percentage, like attendance rates. But if we actually just look at the average number of kids showing up every day, when we've adjusted out the closing schools, you see that our average attendance, your number of kids, is up almost 400 kids this year compared to last year. So that's obviously really positive. Part of that is the extra 100 kids, at Scholar and Compton. But just in general, you know, there's nearly 400 more kids that we're educating every day compared to last year, which is really positive.
How many kids do we end up retaining from the schools we closed?
Looked at this not long ago. want to say it was like 40%, more or less, I think. That's my recollection.
And then you guesstimate on numbers wise, what does that represent?
It was would have been like probably 250.
We got some left from that.
Or two, yeah, between 200 and 250. So this is just, again, the number of kids last year compared to this year. And so you can see a number of the schools made it. And again, the middle schools. All right, so the other part of Big Rock One in terms of creating an anti-racist learning environment has been the work that we're doing in putting together the proactive behavior systems. Amber, do you want to mention just a little bit about what you've been doing there?
So we've been in partnership with LACO and then San Diego Unified for Adelante to do PBIS training. Which is positive behavioral intervention supports training. So we bring together teams across our schools, which include administrators, teachers, ops aides, student services team, and then the regional team that supports them as well, coming together and engaging in this training for them to implement these systems across our schools. I'm excited that across all of our schools, these teams are up and running. We have the training, all schools have attended the training. So they're formed, they're meeting and working together, they're analyzing data and taking action. So it's really exciting. And then the other part of Big Rock One that we've been working on is incident response. So the director of schools team and I, in partnership with some of the student services team, did a lot of work with school leaders to train, develop, and refine our practices on while we're trying to reduce the number of incidents that happen, how when they do happen, because they will. Right? How we respond to them. And so we're hearing from leaders and seeing on the ground the increased clarity on how to respond, and our stronger systems are also in place with the support of our data team. So we're tracking our incidents and being able to disaggregate the data.
So for PBIS compared to whatever we were doing before, do we know, do we have feedback from teachers about how they like it or how they feel it supports them, doesn't support them, whatever?
We don't have feedback yet, but what we're seeing is that teachers are using, we have feedback on they're using incentive systems and they're seeing the impact of those in that classroom. So some of the systems are in place and they're seeing the positive impact of those things.
So the last thing we wanted to touch on in terms of the update was our second big rock, which is around improving the quality of the teachings. And Kavika is going to highlight a few of the early things that we've been doing around this.
Yeah, so I wish I could start right now with sharing SBAC results from last year, our state test. Those are actually embargoed until October 15th. So can't present them in this forum.
So you have them, they just can't be shared, is that
correct? But we are allowed
Academy
to use
awards
them.
Or whatever you've got, like, yeah, the envelope,
yeah.
And
yeah, but there's it's a much bigger group who's allowed to know that. Okay. So we have been able to use them internally for planning purposes. And you know what I can say is that you know, some positive signs, but also there's a lot of work ahead. So we've been able to really use them to drive what our plans are for this year, and really for the next 3-year period right now. So one of the things that we've been doing is taking our end of last year scores, as well as our beginning of year diagnostics that Kyle was mentioning through iReady and through DIBLES, which is an early foundational literacy skills assessment. And what we've done is we've gone through all 9,800 students and created individualized goals for every single student based on their current level. Truthfully, what we're seeing in the data is that we know a lot of our students are not yet at grade level. Some of them who are not yet there are close, and we've been able to set goals that help them get there this year. There are others where we see that the academic gaps are a 2 or 3, in some cases more, but often a 2 or 3 year pathway to get them up to grade level proficiency. So what we want, the premise of all of our goal setting has been that if you're already on grade level, it's extremely important that we maintain it. So if you're entering, you know, fourth grade, having mastered everything from third grade, our responsibility is to teach you everything in fourth grade, make sure you enter fifth grade having mastered everything in fourth grade, so that we really maintain your proficiency levels. However, if you're not yet on grade level, what we know is that 1 year of growth, which is what a teacher would be expected to do with a student in a typical situation, right, is you're in front of me for a year, I'm going to make sure you make a year of growth. But if you're behind grade level, that will never catch you up. So it's very important that those students were actually setting goals and intervention structures so they make greater than 1 year of growth. So we put them on the pathway to grade level proficiency, even if it's a multi-year pathway. So what we've done is we've set different goals by tiers based on where you're coming in. So if you're already on grade level, you need to maintain that. If you're not on grade level, we actually need to meet what we're calling stretch goals in order to really put you back on that pathway. So, so far I have met with 17 out of our 20 school leaders. We've gone through every single student in their school. We have set goals for every student. We've rolled those up so that, you know, we have grade level, school-wide, and then regional-wide goals based on, like I said, the data from last year, which I will share when I after on October 16th. So that's how we're using that process. So frankly, while we know we have work, I also want to say, like, 1 year is not going to get us to our ultimate goal, which is obviously 100%. We know we're still on a multi-year pathway to that.
How often once the goals are set, let's say for the children who need to come up, how often does the team meet or to discuss progress, or just generally speaking, how do you monitor that?
Yeah, actually different for different students. So for example, I'm going to give you the example of how we're using DIBLES, which is our reading early literacy skills. Students are actually categorized by how often we should be progress monitoring them. So a student who is well below, we actually are progress monitoring them as often as every 2 weeks and collecting new data, because that is like basic phonics skills where we actually can make a lot of movement in 10 to 12 days of instruction. Some students who are already on grade level and reading on grade level, there's no need to do that level of every 2 weeks. So we actually have every teacher has a differentiated list based on where students come in with their diagnostic of even how often you're retesting, so that we can check if your interventions are working. And then school teams are talking about these, you know, very often, school leadership teams, the directors of schools are meeting with school leaders about it pretty much on a monthly basis right now. And it is differentiated by school. Like, there are schools, and actually this is something I was going to talk about in a slide, so let me get to it, is that, you know, one of the interventions we noticed really worked with some schools, like I went in and did very regular data meetings with them, and that's something that helped progress our results. So we're differentiating. At other schools, the systems are so in place that, you know, the director of school, the leadership team, they're handling it. Other places that are building systems, that's where like me or someone else from our team might go and meet with them very regularly about their data. So it is a differentiated system. And everyone has checkpoints after our unit assessments to stop and look at it. We have a regionalized assessment calendar for the second year in a row, and that's really helping us with our monitoring of, okay, everyone should have taken a math, you know, the unit one math test by September 30th. That means the first week of October, we can all go in and look and see what progress has been made.
And are the teachers doing okay with all these individualized plans? It sounds like a lot.
Mostly they like it because it's really helping them target, right? It's frustrating to put in a lot of hard work and not see progress. And so I think they've already been working that hard, but now it's providing them the tools to say, oh, this is the skill the student needs help in. So while we still have a lot of skill building to do, like, it turns out if you're a sixth grade teacher and you have a student who's not reading in your teacher credentialing program, that is not something you were trained how to do. So we have a lot of skill building to do of our own people right now in those kind of areas. But I actually think it's a relief to know where to intervene instead of just feeling like my students are so behind grade level, I don't know what to do. Mm-hmm.
Given you have this granularity in the data now by student, which can be a little less, is there a dashboard we can see at like the board level, maybe once every other board meeting or something? See, it sounds like you're going to be doing some pretty regular updating, but it would be really good to see just high level like categorization of like, are the kids at grade level, below grade level on a 1 year track, below grade level on a 2 year track, or below grade level on a 3 year, just some broad level. And it'd be cool to see if we can drive that over the course of a year or even the course of multiple years. As now that you have the data and it looks like you'll be actually driving change, you know, and keeping pulse of the change.
Yeah, I think yes, And the best apples to apples comparisons happen at the beginning of year, middle of year, and end of year, because we take the same assessment on the same standards. So that's when we get the most accurate data. And then in the in-between times, we're using other assessment systems that are, you know, not exactly the same, but are indicators for us. But like, for example, when we finish our middle of year testing, you know, in mid-December, we can absolutely roll up and say, these are the number of students who are on track to meet their goal. And these are the number of students who are not on track. What are we doing about that? So, you know, like the first week of January, we would have all that.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah. You don't just send those three touch points in the year, but it'd be ultimately, this is what this is all driving towards, is the improvement of the educational experience.
Yeah. And, you know, I can share, for example, because it's internal data, you know, DIBELS, again, which is the reading assessment, our goal was to have 100% of kindergartners leave on grade level. We did not hit that goal this past year. But, you know, we had like some of our schools, for example, KIPP Promesa hit 81%, KIPP Vita hit 79%. So there's a, and then we had those two schools actually share out what systems and structures they used with the rest of our school leaders to really talk about how they drove those kinds of results. While we're not at our 100%, they're really approaching it. So we're excited to see some promising practices that are also helping us make some shifts in other schools. So as I mentioned, what high level, what we did see is that where we put some strategic supports into specific schools, we did see some significant growth. And again, you'll see that data in a few weeks. And based on that, we've really thought through how we can expand and replicate some of those supports. So some of the strategies we're using to do that is we are growing the teaching and learning team, one of the teams that I lead. We have hired two early literacy coaches who are both former school leaders, one from within KIPP SoCal, one from another organization. They are working each intensely with three schools on the ground to really support our leaders and our teacher leaders, like grade level chairs that really lead a lot of the content planning on their own early literacy content knowledge, how to best execute lessons on phonics, how to best intervene based on the DIBELS data. So we already have two people on the ground supporting six of our schools that way, looking for one more person. We've also added, we're searching for three math positions total. We want two coaches, like the literacy ones that I've described, to really drive our math results, as well as another math specialist to help us with some of the curriculum changes we're anticipating in the next year. So we're ongoing searches for those. We've also upscoped one of our literacy positions to director to oversee a much bigger scope of work right now on literacy. So in addition to that growth, you know, Naomi already mentioned this, like our data systems are getting more robust, more consistent. This is the first year we've moved everyone over to the same two assessments from iReady to iReady and DIBELS. It's helping us have that consistency as well as be able to see like, oh, Vita did well, Promesa did well. How can we share those practices? In addition, we have shifted to more of a portfolio model in our school support. So the same director of schools, the same operation support, the same teaching and learning support from my team, they're all working with the same cluster of four schools together. So that's helping us just be more sort of laser focused on what like the wraparound supports for a specific school need to be, and really figuring out which schools need not just you know, the tier one base level support, but more intense support or tier two or tier three supports, so that we can differentiate our supports between schools based on those needs as well. Some of that's student achievement, some of that's, you know, how new the school leadership team is, some of that's schools that have vacancies are needing more support. So really wrapping that all up. And then the other exciting thing that we've rolled out is, you know, a year ago, as we began last school year, we realized that we had about 100 first-year teachers, which is not a norm for KIPP SoCal. The teaching profession has shifted. It's less this year because our you know, our retention is so much better. Oh. So while there are fewer this year, we're seeing more and more need to really develop novice teachers, which was not, you know, 10 years ago at the historical need of KIPP SoCal. And so we have really seen the need to support our novice teachers, but also support our instructional leaders, our school leaders, our assistant principals, and really knowing how to coach up you know, first and second year teachers, which is a different skill set. So we've actually created some new materials, new resources. We've hired somebody to be an associate director of new teacher development. And what we've done is we've created a foundational skill sequence that really helps leaders know which skills to work on with first year teachers first, you know, what they should master first, what should they master second. Like, think, what order do you learn math? But this is, what order do you learn teaching? And we're providing ongoing support now for our leaders in learning how to coach these first year teachers, because we know it's crucial to student success that we figure out how to make novice teachers really good, really fast. And then just a couple of other things. One is that we've increased our focus on our leadership teams at school levels, getting a lot of professional development about how to be stronger instructional coaches. You know, Kyle talked about the Whetstone system that is helping us also monitor, you know, how often coaching is happening, helping us see the quality of coaching, again, so we can make differentiated plans. We're doing a lot more norming with our leaders around what we see in classrooms, what the next step would be. We have the data systems, so use that to drive instructions. Those are all kind of things that are becoming more robust for us right now, in addition to the things we've already been doing, like our training from Research for Better Teaching, which we've talked about in the past, as well as a lot of the regional supports that we provide to all schools around things like our assessment calendar, so that we're all, you know, testing in the same week and can look at the data together and see what's happening and which students are making progress, which students are not.
Do we need to move, or
we need to get moving? But I have to ask one question.
Do we look at things like how well school leaders are developing teachers, like in aggregate, as like part of their assessment? You know, as or, and how much they're retaining their teachers, and like sort of a lot of the things we've been talking about. Do those things roll up to some sort of assessment of the school leader?
Amber, feel free to chime in here, but I think there's two things that we are doing, and then a couple where I think we could improve. One is that all teachers we have a teacher practice rubric. All teachers, for their own development reasons, get scores on those at least 4 times a year, so that they know how they're doing. But we do have sort of a minimum bar set of where we expect teachers to be after coaching for a year. And so that is something that we are able to roll up now through the Whetstone system of how many teachers are meeting the floor goal, at least if I can call it that, you know, a rating of a 3 in certain areas.
Is it you rating them, or is it the school leader rating them?
The manager of the teacher rates them, but it's all visible to the school leaders.
Right. But so if you're a bad manager and you're rating someone who's not good highly, like that's going to show up in the system as like, oh, their scores are good. They look great, but they're not, you know, they're not actually getting it
done. Will you go to the next slide? Because I think I can explain this.
So we do alignment and there we go. Alignment and norming. And also, in fact, yesterday I met with the directors of schools team. We talked about them observing with school leaders and then observing with their dean or assistant school leader, observing a lesson, watching the coaching. So those cycles also help with alignment and norming on the ratings being consistent.
So, like, for example, Randy, what you see here on the left is Melissa, who's one of our directors of schools. In the middle there is with an entire school leadership team that's Kip Corazon Upper. They are walking classrooms together. They actually have the tool in hand, and they are making sure that they all rated the teacher the same way, so that we have our directors of schools involved in kind of that process of norming. And you're right. And one of the things that Amber and I look at is when we see something that feels off to our own observations, then that means going in and doing more intense work on that. What you see on the right here is one of our school leaders, Mia, actually coaching one of her deans on how to coach the teacher, so that the school leader is also supporting their leaders and how to do that.
Yeah, I guess what I'm trying to think about is, you know, there's the thing that like A people hire A's and B's hire C's.
Right.
So if you have a school leader that's not strong,
right,
and they're not hiring good people, and they're all kind of misaligned in terms of their assessments or what they're looking at. It doesn't seem like this is a system that's going to flag that, despite all the attempts at norming and teaching. Yeah. Like, there needs to be another system or something.
I completely agree. And I think what partial solution is, the other portion of this, is that all teachers have a student achievement goal. That's based on those individualized student goals we set.
Sure.
So every teacher actually gets a student achievement goal that they must hit. And those student achievement goals for each teacher get rolled up to school leader goals. So a school leader's performance evaluation, for example, includes how many of their teachers hit their student achievement goals. So that is like our more foolproof of, at the end of the day, whatever you rated the teacher, the thing that counts is, did your kids grow? Did your kids hit proficiency? We're looking at student achievement as the actual outcome that matters.
And are you flagging like where student achievement is lagging, but the rating is high, for example, like those?
Yes. This is actually quite honestly a problem we noticed last year, which is why we put a lot more effort into the development and norming around it. And you're right, it's not a foolproof system.
It, well, I mean, there's only some. All right, we can take it offline.
So before we get started on compliance, we need to update the role.
Well, I'm just gonna call into the record. When I hit record, I didn't realize there was a second time I needed to hit, so we didn't record the start of our meeting. So I just want to call into the record that our meeting was called to order at 1:03 p.m. Naeem is present. John is absent. Carlos joined us at 1:16. Randy's present. Mel present. Bill is absent. Heather present. Julie joined us at 1:53. And Luis is present.
Okay.
Can continue.
So now we can go on with compliance and voting items. Kyle, you have the first item.
Yeah, the first one is just the presentation, the opportunity for discussion, and ultimately approval of our submission of our unaudited actual reports for all of our schools. This is the end of year report when we submit our preliminary financial results for every LEA. Mostly it's income statement. There is a small balance sheet portion. Those have all been provided to you in your materials. So happy to take any questions. Otherwise, looking for a
small
proceed. Randy,
question? Well, sorry, any questions? We usually aren't on this.
I'm trying to make up for the last time.
I'll make a motion.
We have a second.
I'll second.
I am in first. All right.
Naeem?
Yes.
Carlos? He's stepped away. Randy?
Yes.
Mel?
Yes.
Heather?
Yes.
Julie?
Yes.
Luis?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Motion passes. Now I will turn it over to Curtis. Welcome, Curtis.
Good afternoon, board members. My name is Curtis Watley. I'm the director of Policy and Authorizer Relations here at SoCal. Today, I'm bringing two resolutions to the board. Both resolutions seek the board's permission to submit material revisions of our charters to the Los Angeles Unified High School District. Both of these material revisions propose enrollment increases, and both of these material revisions propose adding a facility to serve transitional kindergarten students. The first of these resolutions is for Kip Corazon Academy. Corazon currently enrolls 1,063 students in grades TK through 8, which is slightly above the charter stated enrollment capacity. And there are currently 310 kids on Corazon's books. In response to high community demand, KIPP SoCal seeks the board's permission to submit a material revision to the Los Angeles Unified School District, proposing to increase Corazon's enrollment capacity to 1,205 students. To accommodate this increase, the material revision will also propose adding 6438 Seville Avenue in Huntington Park as one of the facilities listed in Corazon's charter. 6348 Seville Avenue would begin serving Corazon's TK students in 2025-26. The facility is less than 3 miles away from Corazon's lower school at 9325 Long Beach Boulevard, and less than 3 miles away from Corazon's upper school at 8616 Long Beach Boulevard. The facilities will be conducive to implementing a play-based model that provides social, emotional, executive functioning, and language development opportunities to TK students.
Any questions? All right. Do we have a first one? Your motion.
I'll second.
Do it.
Okay. Nine?
Yes.
Carlos? Don't step away. Randy?
Aye.
Mel?
Yes.
Heather?
Yes.
Julie?
Yes.
Luis?
Yes.
So the second of these resolutions is for Kit Comienza Community Prep. Comienza currently enrolls 1,076 students in grades TK through 8, which is slightly above the charter's stated enrollment capacity. And there are currently 853 kids on Comienza's waitlist. Here again, in response to high community demand, KIPP SoCal seeks the board's permission to submit a material revision to LAUSD, proposing to increase Comienza's enrollment capacity to 1,205 students. To accommodate this increase, this material revision also proposes adding 6348 Seville Avenue in Huntington Park as the facility for TK students in Comienza's charter. Here again, 6348 Seville Avenue would begin serving Comienza's TK students in the 25-26 school year, in effect sharing the facility with Collins and Corazon. The facility is less than 3 miles away from Comienza's lower school, 7300 Rosebery Avenue, and less than 3 miles away from the site of Comienza's future upper school at 7825 Santa Fe Avenue. And as I mentioned earlier, the facility will be conducive to implementing a play-based model that provides social, emotional, executive functioning, and language development opportunities for TK students.
All right, do we have a motion for
does Randy motion?
Second. Randy?
Yes.
Randy?
Yes.
Mel?
Yes.
Heather?
Yes.
Julie?
Yes.
Luis?
Yes. Motion passes. Thank you.
Curtis.
Okay, Lindsay.
Happy.
Welcome.
Hey, everyone. Hello. Yeah, it's been a while since I've been in front of you all. Typically, my colleague Hunter comes up with mine. So today I'm talking about LCAP. You have seen this before. You've seen this before in March. Not new. But what we're presenting today is that the version in June did not have the annual update from the previous three-year plan attached. And so at the request of our authorizers, we are resubmitting for approval with that annual update attached to this LPAP. The content of the LPAP, which outlines our goals, academic strategies, expenditures for the next 3 years, has not changed. We're simply sort of adding those two components together to present. So I'm asking for the board's approval of the revised LPAP.
Are there any questions? Go ahead, Lisa.
No, are there any questions?
All right. We have a motion.
Move.
Julie?
Second.
Is Randy a second?
Ryan?
Yes.
Randy?
Yes.
Mel?
Yes.
Heather?
Yes.
Julie?
Yes.
Luis?
Yes. Motion passes. Thank you, Lisa. Okay, moving on to the next, we have a couple of presentations that are required updates for the board to receive. Our first one is will be Ivana. Welcome.
Good afternoon, board members. My name is Ivana Castro, and I'm the Authorizer Relations Manager here at KIPP SoCal. Today, I will provide you an overview of both LAUSD's 23-24 Oversight Report and SDUSD's 23-24 Site Visit Report. And as I understand it, our Chief of Staff, Belen Sanchez, has made the full oversight reports available to you, and they should be in the document section of your board packet. So today, I will start with the 23-24 LAUSD oversight reports. In the 23-24 school year, LAUSD authorized 17 KIPP SoCal schools. Every year, LAUSD conducts an annual oversight visit at each school to ensure that we are complying with applicable law and the terms of our charter. After the oversight visit, the Charter Schools Division will issue final oversight reports that scores each school on a 1-4 scale in the following categories: governance, student achievement, organizational management, and fiscal operations. So there's the scale, and these are all of our scores. So first we will start with governance. So every school received either a score of 4 accomplished or 3 proficient in governance. One thing I really want to highlight for this school year is that our schools cannot receive a rating greater than 3 if they receive a score of 2 or 1 in any other category. So that accounts for the variance in the governance category between which schools received a 3 and which schools received a 4. So next I will move on to the student achievement section. So the student achievement section was scored according to the school's performance on the California School Dashboard. More specifically, LAUSD is reviewing our school's performance on academic indicators from 22-23 school year. 6 schools received a rating of 3, meaning proficient. However, we saw a higher frequency of 2s in student achievement than in past years, which is attributable to our school's ongoing recovery from the pandemic and why the call to go all in on academics couldn't be more urgent. This year, we are proud to report that all schools received a rating of 3 or 4 in the organizational management category. This indicates that our schools have the systems in place to keep our students safe, engage stakeholders, comply with applicable laws, and implement the key features of their educational program. And now moving on to fiscal operations, the majority of our schools receive high marks. The board will notice that LAUSD issued ratings of 4 to 7 Kent SoCal schools. 9 Kent SoCal schools received a rating of proficient 3 due to one of the following reasons. 2 audit findings from 22-23, 4 failure to meet one of LAUSD's criteria for a 4, which could be not having the 5% cash balance at the beginning of the year. And now I will go over to STUSD's site visit report. Similar to LAUSD, San Diego conducts an in-person site visit at Kent Adelante. Something to note with the San Diego Unified Site Visit Report is that it is qualitative. There is no scale score. So their document summarizes the document submissions preceding the site visit and also summarizes data on student enrollment, academic outcomes, operations, and fiscal management. Overall, SUSD noted that Kip Adelante met the majority of expectations and has a consistent track record of compliance with applicable deadlines. When necessary, we made revisions to our policy, an example being our home education policy. Additionally, the report noted that Kip Adelante met the district's criteria of financial stability and sustainability. And San Diego Unified noted that based on the 23 dashboard, Kip Adelante is categorized as a middle performing school. And that concludes my overview of both LAUSD and San Diego Unified's site visit reports. I'm available for any questions.
Yeah, can we go back a slide?
Yes.
So the student achievement one, will that with the a lot of what you're doing now with the data, it'll help us track. It should coincide, right, with the student achievement column, and our standardized testing scores will have a better pulse on that.
Yes, right. These are spring of 23. I internally know spring of 24, and all the things we're putting in place right now are hopefully to impact the spring of 25 scores being better. And yes, I think we can monitor. I think we have some good predictive data now that will tell us how we're going to do in spring of 25. But I also know that our proficiency levels that we need, we probably need a 2 to 3 year runway to get to, you know, back to the pre-pandemic kind of scoring that we
like
were
does
at.
Any of that surprise any of those right. surprise you on the student achievement?
Does this match up with our own assessment?
Yeah, we view our SBAC scores from 22-23.
So, you know, it's it lines up completely with those, with the outcomes on proficiency on those.
Okay.
And are there any red flags that Unified raised with any of these scores with us?
Not specifically to KIPP. I think one thing they flag, especially this year with the with the designations for middle and low performing coming out, if the school is categorized as low performing, it's an automatic one. Oversight reports were a little bit delayed in coming out because all districts and SoCal ourselves, we were waiting for CDE to release the classification categories. So it was more of like keeping in mind how the student achievement category specifically is more aligned to the California dashboard. So if the school is underperforming the state, that kind of automatically gives us.
Why is the fiscal operations for Pueblo Unido 2?
So it's a variety of factors. So it's the two audit findings, as well as these are also snapshots of the visit at the time. So at the time of their visit in May, it was due to the fiscal condition of the school at that time. Especially since it was one of our schools at the high school. So it just wasn't meeting LAUSD secretary to be.
I think at that point we had let their net assets reflect the real condition of the school, which was negative. So because again, they're not looking at this as an org wide level; they're looking at it on a school by school basis. And the fiscal, solvency of the school was one of the reasons we ended up closing the school. So this is not a surprise and reflective of the reality. It's not going to reflect on the org. It was that. We should probably keep moving unless there's
any other questions or any questions. Thank you. Thank you, Ivana.
Thank you, Ivana.
Okay. Moving on for the next update with Coral.
Hello, my name is Coral Miller. I'm the Associate Director of Workforce Analytics. And I'm here with Shane Tracer, who's the Director of Workforce Analytics. And we're here to present to you on the CHIP SoCal's Teacher Assignment Monitoring Outcomes. So what are the Teacher Assignment Monitoring Outcomes, or TAMO for short? It is a data set derived from the series of compliance reporting submissions that happened during the school year. Each year, KIPP SoCal submits teacher placement data to the California Department of Ed, or CDE, through the California Longitudinal Pupil Achievement Data, or CalPADS. CDE then sends that data to the Commission on Teacher Credentialing, or CTC, which house and issue all of the state's teacher credentials. And basically, they create a new dashboard called CalSAS. And CalSAS is the California State Assignment Accountability Monitoring System. And basically, it looks to match that placement data that we submitted with the educator's credential with the CDC's dashboard. During the monitoring period, KIPP SoCal works with our charter authority to go through any undetermined assignments. And the result of those teaching assignments are then posted as the teacher assignment monitoring outcomes. So we're presenting on KIPP SoCal's TAMO data today because it's now included in California's overall accountability system, the local priority indicators, which measure and assess how schools are meeting the needs of their students. The local priority indicators are how California stays in compliance with the Every Student Succeeds Act, or ESSA. And measuring appropriately assigned teachers falls under local priority indicator one and should be reported to our governing board each year. However, TAMO is a new system implemented in 2019, and data was not made available to share until July 10th of this year. And they included data from the 2021-22, and 2022-23 school years, which is what we'll be sharing with you all today. We will continue to share this data each year as soon as it's provided to SAE and to be compliant. Right. So before we begin looking at our TAMRO data, we wanted you to be familiar with a new CDE classification. The CDE created these classifications to help stakeholders understand the overall state of our assignment data in California, as well as to comply with SM requirements. As you can see, we group these classifications as ESSA aligned or ESSA misaligned. For our presentation today, we'll talk through what an ineffective placement means as it falls under that ESSA misaligned. There are a few scenarios that fall under ineffective placement. One being an educator who had attention credentialing, but it didn't quite match the subject that they're teaching. For example, an educator who is teaching science but holds a single subject English credential. That would be considered ineffective placement could also be educators who are solely on temporary compliance documents or don't hold any teaching credential at all. Again, we'd like to reiterate these are classifications that the CDE did come up with, and they don't necessarily represent how SoCal use our instructional staff. But now that we have some background on what TAMRO is, I will pass you on to Shane to dive into the data.
Thanks, Carl. So in the appendix that you've received, you're going to find reports by school, then reports by grade band, and then reports by subject area. The subject area reports only include subjects that KIPSOCAL teaches. There are several other subjects in the data set. In that report, you'll find information about our authorizing districts, the county that the school is placed in or the counties we work in, and the school itself, as well as in the subject sections, information about other charter schools in the area, larger CMOs like Alliance and Aspire. To begin, I want to give you an overview of the outcomes at the district level in our authorizing districts, and then at the county level in the two counties we serve. You can see that, generally speaking, traditional public schools in blue range between 2 and 5%, or this percent ineffective. This is what we'll be looking at for the next several slides. Obviously, you can also look at clear and out of place, or out of field, and intern credentials as aligned. But we figured looking at the single number would be clearer. Charter schools tend to range between about 5 and 10%. KIPSOCAL, if you look at the very last page of your appendix, saw 11% ineffective in 2021, 10% ineffective in 21-22, and 15% ineffective in 22-23, which is the latest year of data we have. If we move to the next slide, you can now see the data split out by grade band. This first is for our elementary schools. You'll notice several schools missing here are the schools with upper and lower campuses. Those can't be disaggregated in TAMRO data. They're presented as a single school serving grades TK through 8. And so that's the third set of schools you'll see in your appendix, starting at the dog-eared page. Generally speaking, our elementary schools tend to see percent ineffective that is near other charter schools in the area. Their overall year-over-year variance is largely due to their smaller sample size. So a very large difference, like you see at VITA, can actually only represent 3 or 4 teachers who are now ineffective year-over-year. Moving to the next slide, looking at our middle school campuses, you'll see that their percent ineffective tends to be much higher. This is largely due to the challenges in placing teachers in some of those core subjects, like math and science especially. So you'll see that reflected in the school level data. A couple of places where you may be sort of looking for bright spots are Adelante's placements and Philosophers, who have been making choices and been able to hire staff and retain staff who are in aligned placements. And then this next slide here, we're looking at our TK through 8 schools, calling your attention just to a couple of spots. Corazon's most recent increase is largely due to, again, their sample size. That a big jump represents 4 placements. And then at Compton, again, sample size is the big problem. At Corazon, you'll also find in the school report that inexperienced teachers, so teachers in their first and second year, represent a large proportion of their ineffective placements. One thing we want to note is that new teachers to the profession are not by nature ineffective. If you hold an intern credential, that is an aligned credential. The challenge comes with the timeliness of intern credentials, which can sometimes be awarded late in the school year, even if you've been teaching all year. During that time, you're on typically an emergency 30-day permit. Those are not effective placements, according to the CDE.
Sorry.
Yes.
Are the percentages the percent of teachers that are teaching in the school that are ineffective, or of the placements that were made that year?
So it's technically the percent of full-time equivalent placements, which in our cases typically represent teachers, but it can also represent part of a teacher's day. So if a teacher is credentialed, for example, for secondary math, they teach four periods of secondary math and two periods of secondary science. Their FTE is 60% effective and 20% ineffective. So an individual teacher may be entirely ineffective in this data set. They may also be partially ineffective or have.
It's a great choice of words, but so high level, this is just what percent of teachers in that school don't have the right credential for whatever they're teaching?
That's okay. So the real question now is, so what? And the answer to that is a little vague still. As Coral mentioned, this is part of the school accountability dashboard and the school accountability system. There isn't currently any kind of cutoff or score that determines whether our proportion of ineffective placements are, you know, bad or acceptable or anything. But that's not to say that that couldn't change over the next several years as that legislation changes. Broadly speaking, as a best practice, we want to keep the proportion of placements that are marked as ineffective as low as possible, knowing that, you know, there are always going to be those instances that we can't necessarily control. So we wanted to share with you some thoughts and insights about why this is happening at SoCal, why our proportion of, you know, quote unquote, ineffective placements is relatively high compared to other charter schools. Some of these are just sort of environmental factors. Kevika mentioned earlier, our teacher pool is younger and more inexperienced than they used to be. This is largely due to the CTC's decrease in awarded credentials. That is partially due to lower enrollment in credentials. That's partially due to the onerous nature of credentialing programs, the testing required, the relatively high bar for entry in some cases. We've seen a 24% decrease statewide in issued teaching credentials, and that's been especially challenging for special ed credentials, or called specialist credentials, where we've seen a 31% decrease in issued credentials. Our teacher pool, as it gets increasingly smaller and inexperienced, are also facing challenges in their first couple of years teaching, so it's harder to retain them. When you're a first-year teacher, you're full-time teaching as an intern and also earning your credential, which can be really challenging. Or you've gone through the traditional student-teacher route, which means that you are not being paid for your first year of teaching, and then you jump into the profession, both of which are really challenging. And the last are just the decision-making challenges that face our school leaders and school teams. When a vacancy arrives, especially partway through the year, you want to fill it as quickly as possible to get a qualified adult in that classroom. And credentialing compliance isn't always forefront in that decision-making process. So what are we doing to address the issue? You can see the top two bullets are about how we're increasing the pool of applicants. We are working with Loyola Marymount University and Alder School of Education to build a teacher residency program and to work with new intern teachers. So a lot of that is in-house folks, instructional aides, or instructional assistants who we spot talent in and who have interest. We push into the program. We also just work with those programs to build our own new pool of teachers. We've seen a 38% increase in cohort size year over year for the residency program and a 64% increase in intern enrollment at LMU in the last couple of years. Our dedicated and small but mighty credentialing team is focused on a daily basis, providing support to teachers, answering questions and coordinating their credentialing experience, and supporting our school leaders to help make informed decisions about appropriate credentials to use for different placements. Our recruitment, credentialing, and new teacher development teams work really hard to make sure that, especially for our new teachers, they're getting as much support as they can. We offer financial support for teachers who are experiencing credentialing. costs. And then we also just provide a ton of professional development to make it easier for them to do the work and to earn that credential. Our team is building some internal compliance monitoring, which is, we expect to have a full version of this in December, but we hope in the next 2 weeks to have a proof of concept of it to understand what the current state of things are. The data we get from TAML is currently on a 2-year lag. So the most recent data set is 22-23. Makes it really hard for us just to understand how things are going and how things have been trending in the last few years. And so this sort of new credentialing compliance tool will help us support school leaders, ensure compliance and accountability, and just have a better insight into how things will look when that TAML data comes out. And finally, we work really closely and will continue to work closely with school leaders to support their decision-making, to support new hiring, and to ensure that credentialed teachers end up in seats in every case that we can. That is what we're doing.
Lots of helpful information. Question.
We could spend a whole day on this. Do we have any questions, comments?
I guess this is through 22, is that right?
Yeah, 22-23 school year, or the 23 fiscal year.
Do we, I mean, I know that it's not through the whole system or whatever, but we must have some idea internally how that looks for 23 or 24.
We're working on our CalSAS responses for last school year right now.
As you saw, it's a very lengthy process to get to the TAML data, right? So currently, the CalSAS that I mentioned monitoring period is happening right now. And so that should be finished at the end of October. And that will then be for the 23-24 school year. So as you can see, it's a pretty big lag and when you receive that information and go through that. And then, so that probably won't be published. That TAML data for the 23-24 would probably be in the summertime.
We expect the outcomes to look pretty similar to last year.
And I guess, I mean, I get that there's, you submit it to this system, it goes through the state system, it goes back, like whatever, there's all the, you know, checking they're doing. But do we just know this? Like, I mean, which of our teachers have credentials for what they're teaching or not and track it? And like, without all the submissions or whatever, is this something we just kind of monitor and have a pretty good sense of where we are?
Yeah, so the interconnectedness of that is really challenging. Knowing exactly what a teacher is teaching at a school site in terms of each of their individual placements is a little tough. Part of what CTC is looking at are the actual instructional codes assigned to a course, and those instructional codes are managed in a platform called Infinite Campus. So we're working with the data team to get better, more robust, and more frequent access to that information. We do have information about our current credentials through a platform called Helios that we use. And so the other piece that's happening, the internal compliance monitoring work we're doing, is trying to build that map between what an individual teacher's course assignments are and their credential. The challenge is that the mapping that exists from the CTC is complex and archaic, essentially, and has to be scraped from the internet. They don't have a downloadable data set of which credentials are on paper, which courses. So we're still guessing at a lot of that right now. But our goal is that in the next 3 or so months, we will be able to answer that question on a pretty regular basis.
Thanks. Any other questions?
Are we concerned about this as an order? What level of concern do we have on this situation?
The term ineffective is wrong, right? Like this, we don't see a strong correlation between this and like the actual true effectiveness of the teacher. So we need to pay attention to it because it is important to have properly credentialed teachers. But I don't think among the things we're worried about, I would not say this rises near the top of the list.
And I think it's fair to say that just because someone has a credential, it doesn't mean that they're an effective teacher.
That's for sure.
Yeah, and we can be in compliance without, right. Like, we're generally in compliance. It's just not all with these fully cleared credentials. So we're certainly making sure, like, we are in compliance with the rules. Yeah.
Just in the study that Ivana had shared with the columns and the scores, I just wanted to highlight that in the organizational practice where all of our schools had a 3 and 4, they check real-time credentials every year. And so appropriately assigned, like, do you have the compliant document to teach the subject? Like that is checked on the ground every year by our authorizer and ourselves. And so that's why you saw 3 and 4. Those are good scores.
And there's also, just to be clear, there's also a limit as to how long a teacher can go without a credential, correct?
Yes.
We had an issue a couple of years ago that we had, a very short period of time to prepare. And I think were things like, my memory's a little fuzzy, but I remember that it was somebody was teaching something that they weren't specifically credentialed for.
This is science, right?
This is science.
Yes, and I think what the majority of this thing is, it's like the temporary documents that are still compliant, but not a full credential, like fully cleared credential. And that's a little different than like the missed assignments or the not knowing. So I agree with Kyle. I think the huge worry because we are having those annual checks where it's compliant and appropriately assigned.
So I think two things we would add to that are that this data is from a snapshot in time. It's based on norm day data beginning of October. That's why we might see a difference in what is available in TAMO in terms of what is an appropriate assignment and what comes out of our authorizer visits later in the year. Because what is true later in the year may be different from what was true in October, where, for example, an intern teacher has earned their intern credential, making them a clear placement.
Also, I just want to reiterate what Lindsay brought up. The temporary compliance documents is a good chunk of those ineffective documents that you saw. So we rarely have teachers who are not in or don't have any credential in front of students. A lot of that is from those temporary compliance documents. Which does make us comply with the state of California because they are contributing to a specific ed out that California has created, basically to fill the need of the vacancies that California has been experiencing for a very long time. The state just says that basically the federal government sees it as ineffective because it's not fully credentialed, but they are applying with the state of California.
Thank you, Coral. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, finance.
Put your other hat on.
Yeah. We just have one item to talk about, and there was a resolution provided in your board packet. We'll be looking to get approval of that resolution. It is for financing that we're looking to do in December. It will be for around $36 million. It's to refinance existing debt. So this isn't taking on any additional debt for the organization. The loan is going to be through EFF, or Equitable Facilities Fund. They do it through an issuance through CSFA. So it's kind of similar to the issuing bonds, but it's a private placement with EFF. The pricing on it is going to be the 30-year MMD with 100 basis point spread. So right now it's approximately 4.5%. It'll be for 30 years with a 10-year call period. One nice difference working with EFF then through a bond is we don't have to establish a debt service reserve, so we get some ongoing savings by not having to borrow for that. You see outlined here the uses. So again, about roughly $12 million is to refinance a new market tax credit loan that was used to finance Endeavor's facility and actually the so that Remessa is housed in as well. That loan has to be refinanced by mid-December. And then the way the market is with rates going down a bit, has made it attractive or worthwhile to refinance our 2014 bonds. The 10-year call period has lapsed on that, so it's now eligible to refinance. So you see the majority of this will actually go towards that, about $23.5 million. I'll skip all the way to the bottom. So biggest highlight here is this is going to provide substantial
cash flow savings for us. Some of this is achieved by lowering the interest rate on the 2014 debt, but we're essentially extending that debt out, you know, another 10 years. So we have 20 years left. If we just kept it as is, this is going to reset the period up to 30 years. So that'll make the annual cash flow requirements, you know, go down. I think this is a good strategy for us. It doesn't do us a whole lot of good as an organization to have buildings that are fully paid off, because it's just an asset that doesn't, you know, can't do much with. There's a lot more value to us to lowering our, you know, annual debt service burden. And so that's part of the strategy behind the decision. So that's a summary that, you know, working with EFF, besides the debt service reserve, the issuance costs are a bit lower, so we don't have to pay a large underwriter's fee. Importantly, for me right now, the amount of work required on the front end also is significantly less. We don't have to do an offering statement. Just, you know, work with one lender. We don't have to get a rating up front. So that saves a lot of time as well. It'll be good for us to get an EFS portfolio. They could be a good partner. Any questions?
I do. It looks like a super good idea. I'm wondering, like, how does the reduction in the debt service reserve affect, does it have any real effect on our finances? Right. So with the bond, we had to reserve X amount, blah, 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 and this reduces it, I guess, just on the refinance of the 2014 bond. How does that affect our cash flow or anything?
You're asking specifically about the reserve, not needing the reserve.
A reserve.
It's really just a little bit of, it'll be a little bit of savings on the annual debt service. So if we were to go to the bond market right now, if the annual debt service on this is 2.2, probably we were able to get about a 50% debt service reserve. So we'd have to borrow an extra $1.1 million.
So it reduces our total. It allows us to reduce our total debt, so we don't have to have the money sitting there.
Pay the interest. There's some arbitrage. I mean, you know, you can close that gap by the yield we get on that reserve,
mm-hmm.
Which right now, you know, probably net out to close to zero. But that might not be the case a few years down the road if interest rates continue to fall, you know, below what we've borrowed.
Yeah, I mean, we're never. I mean, the arbitrage is always could be small, right?
Yeah.
So it reduces our debt.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
No. We'll put up the motion.
Yep.
Okay. The motion is to approve the resolution authorizing the transaction, approving the execution, delivery, and performance of the related documents and agreements, and appointing the authorized signatories together with all other actions authorized by the borrowing resolution. Do we have a motion?
This is Randy. I'll make the motion.
Okay. We have a second.
I'll second.
Naeem?
Yes.
Carlos?
Yes.
Randy?
Aye.
Mel?
Yes.
Heather?
Yes.
Julie?
Yes.
Louise?
Yes.
Motion passes.
Okay, exciting. Brown neck training. Destiny. Yeah.
One thing I didn't want to miss. I didn't want to have to do self-study brown neck training.
Welcome.
The highlight of your year, Destiny.
Yes, this is the highlight of the year. I try to make this as interesting as possible, but... and I don't like to read. I like to ad lib, but we have to have it completely concise and required. One thing, there's nothing new this year, so it'll be pretty much the same as last year. So bear with me. All right, so this is our agenda, as we had last year. I don't know if you. All right, what is the Brown Act and its purpose? The Ralph M. Brown Act. California Code 54950 is an act of the California State Legislature authored by Assemblymember Ralph M. Brown and passed in 1953 that guarantees the public's right to attend and participate in meetings of local legislative bodies. California Sunshine Law for local government, based upon state policy that the people must be informed so they can keep control over their government. Enacted in response to mounting public concerns over informal, undisclosed meetings held by local elected officials. Solely applies to California city and county government agencies, boards, and councils, which also includes charter schools. Okay, KIPSO Cal Board must comply with the Brown Act. Charter schools are required to comply. Charter schools, of course, are public schools. SB 126 that was enacted in 2019 and effective as of January 1 of 2020. KIPSO Cal have been following the Brown Act prior to SB 126. It is a LAUSD, Compton Unified. We have LACO, we're not affiliated currently with LACO, and San Diego Unified School District Department. Okay, consequences of not complying. Violations can result in criminal penalties. Criminal penalties. So it'd be a misdemeanor up to 6 months in jail or fine up to $1,000 or both. Costs and attorney's fees may be awarded to those who successfully challenge Brown Act violations. Board action can be ruled null and void. A major factor in assessing and approving new charters and our renewals of our existing charters, very important. And then obviously damage to our organization's reputation. Meeting requirements. What is a meeting? When any congregation of a majority of the members of the body meet to hear, discuss, deliberate, or take action on any item of charter school business. Brown Act applies to meetings of the board, includes formal and informal, and need not constitute an official meeting. All governing board meetings, not committee meetings, must be audio and/or video recorded, posted on all KIPSO Cal websites, including each school's website. Board retreats, private dinners, workshops, etc., constitute a meeting. If a quorum of the board or any standing committee is invited or in attendance, and the meeting includes a discussion of the business within the jurisdiction of the board or the standing committee. Board committees. Nearly all committees must comply with the Brown Act, except a committee that is advisory, not decision-making, composed of only board members, is less than a quorum of the board, and must not be a standing committee, meaning existing to make routine and regular recommendations on a specific subject matter. A majority of the board can attend other bodies, public meeting, public conferences of general interest, purely social or ceremonial gatherings, so long as charter school business is not discussed. Serial meetings, a series of private meetings by which a majority of the members of the board commit to a decision or engage in collective deliberation concerning charter school business violates the Brown Act's open meeting requirement. Must be a limit on one-way communications. While an employee or official may engage in separate conversations or communications with others,
was a worldly report, a summary of the recommendation for final action, including the salary schedule and fringe benefits during the open meeting where final action will be taken. Final action must occur in open session. Notice and agendas. The agenda shall be posted properly in advance of a meeting and must include a brief description of items to be transacted or discussed. With a few exceptions, if an item is not on the agenda, the board cannot discuss it. Contents of agenda. Brief description of each item, usually no more than 20 words. Safe harbor language for closed sessions. How to request disability-related accommodation. Location for inspection of documents distributed to the notice and agendas. When regular meetings, 72 hours notice is required. Special meetings, 24 hours notice is required. Emergency meetings, 1 hour minimum notice is required, which is obviously rare. Word of post. Physically at public accessible location within the jurisdiction during the entire posting period. At all teleconference locations, on the main KIPP SoCal website, and all school websites, specifically on the homepage. Notice and agendas, exception, placing items on the agenda in an emergency. Upon determination by a majority vote of the board that an emergency situation exists, established by A-Code 5495.5, upon determination by 2/3, vote of the board or unanimous vote of those present if less than 2/3 of the members are present, that there is a need to take immediate action and that the need for action came to the attention of KIPP SoCal after the agenda was posted. Permissible closed sessions include conference with legal counsel in regards to pending or anticipated litigation, student discipline, obviously under the Ed Code 48900, personnel issues in terms of appointment, employment, evaluation, discipline, or dismissal. Caveat is 24-hour written notice to employees required if board will hear complaints and will changes. Real estate. Real estate negotiations, labor negotiations, and public security. Requirements must be listed on the agenda with safe harbor language. Safe harbor language has been established by the legislature as what's required to be printed on the agenda. And that's established under Government Code 54954.5. Prior to closed session, the board must make a public announcement of reasons for closed session prior to the commencement of the closed session. Public must have an opportunity to comment. After closed session, the board must make a public report of action taken in closed session and vote for abstention of every board member. Confidentiality is required. Only allow attendance of individuals who have a need to be in the closed session discussing the item. All right, that's it for 2024. If you have any questions, let me know.
Thank you.
I think next time we have to
win. See. Right. Do we have any questions? Any questions from Cecily? No? No questions?
We have a little technological challenge, so just give us a minute.
We can take a quick, we're good on time, 10-minute break before we go into a closed session.
Still have governance, the rest of governance.
Sorry. Okay. So do you need a couple minutes before we're good to go?
I think we should be good. We just want to get this computer back up on the Zoom. So.
Recording in progress.
I'm confused. Are we taking a break?
Yes or no?
No.
No, we're going to get... We're going.
We'll be quick. We just have a couple governance items.
All right.
Okay.
Let me know.
Sorry, we just need a good computer to be up. Okay. So.
All right. Go ahead.
I'm gonna. If you want to go to the next slide. Yeah. Okay, perfect. So as September is our annual board meeting, we wanted to do a check-in on how we did as a board with respect to our goals for last year. If y'all remember, we set three goals for board members as a whole. So the first was around our meeting attendance. We didn't do so great there, but I know I feel really confident in all of you and all of us that this is the year we're going to do this. While we're on the topic of attendance, you know, Angela was very adamant to make sure that we do bring our attendance awards again this year. So with a threshold of, because remember, we don't go for perfect attendance, because that's not a thing, but for excellent attendance, and with the goal of 90% of excellent attendance, we have three board members who met that, so thank you. So we have Carlos.
I can't keep it with me all.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Exactly. As well. Yeah. Yes. So we look forward to handing out more of these next year.
Should come with like a little candy bar.
Yeah.
Good idea.
Water bottle. There should be some.
I don't really want
water. It does the trick.
Okay, good to know. Taking a note of that.
And retroactive.
It's on expanding the list.
Oh, and then in terms of engagement opportunities, we had set the goal last year for 100% of board members to attend at least three opportunities, including at least one visit. We had two of our board members achieve that. And again, we're going to talk about this for this upcoming year. And then for our giving goal for 100% of board members to participate in Giving Tuesday, and we celebrated that, I think, at our last December meeting. And thank you again for your participation in that. Next slide, please. So in working with the governance committee, we reestablished goals. You'll see the first and the meeting attendance and the giving goal have remained the same. We still want to get to 80% of attendance across the board of our board and continue with our giving goal. For engagement opportunities, we did take into account and the feedback around, you know, the number of different meetings, committee meetings and pieces. And so we have changed this to at least two engagement opportunities, and at least one of those to be a school visit. We think and know it's really important for our board to be able to see our schools and for our schools to be able to meet with the board members. We did offer a few of those last year, and I think for those who were able to attend, was just a really great opportunity to be on the site. So we're in the process of getting dates. We're gonna offer four visits throughout the year. We're hoping to have our first one sometime in November, but our goal will be to get those dates out early so y'all can plan ahead and you can go to more than one school visit, but we'll have various options for the board related to that. And then next slide, please. So just really in working on that, some next steps related to board member goals is this is something that the governance committee monitors throughout the year. As I mentioned, we're working to schedule our four visits throughout the year and to do that. And then the resources, just wanted to remind everyone, we do have the board meeting calendar. If for some reason you need me to resend that to you, I'm happy to do so. On there, we put our board meeting dates, of course, committee meeting dates, and then other events that come up that, you know, we would like to invite the board to. Board on Track is our platform for that, and I am also a resource in all of this. So and then related, so that's kind of an overview for board member goals. I'm gonna pass it over to Joseph, who one of our goals is around Giving Tuesday, so he's gonna share a little bit about that. So thank you, Joseph.
Hi everyone, glad to be with you today. So really quick on Giving Tuesday. The board has been amazing the past 3 years. I've been running Giving Tuesday. This will be my fourth running it this year, looking to again raise $185,000. Last year, we were able to surpass that by a wide margin, so we'll be looking for that support this upcoming Giving Tuesday, where your support is 100% participation by the board. And just again, want to reiterate, a gift of any size is much, much appreciated, and also if you're able to share Giving Tuesday with your networks, colleagues, etc., please do so when you have an opportunity. I'm able to provide some resources as far as communication materials as well for Giving Tuesday, should that be needed. And that's that. And also, to also give a couple of updates regarding our gala, which will be on October 10th. We've been doing amazing. We actually sold out tables and sponsorships for our gala. We're expecting close to 500 people at the Super Bowl. So it's amazing. Again, to everyone on the board that's been supporting, and also to a lot of the new folks as well, to Kip Soka. We expect a lot of visitors that we, as the film team, are looking to engage with to get them to be more involved. It's not just that one time gets to the gala, looking for them to become longtime supporters of our viewing. So I know Luis will be reaching out to you as well then with some support on the gala as well too. So I'll turn it over to Luis for that.
Well, first off, I want to thank all the board members for your support. You have been extremely charitable and generous in what you've pledged to give, and that is just amazing. So all of us are very, very thankful for your generosity. And thankfully, I think the majority of us will be there. One of the things that Joseph touched on, we're going to have a somewhat of a mini task for you at the event, which will give you names of folks that we'd love for you to connect with in conversation and talk about Kip. For those folks who are not all that familiar, but who are there supporting the event. And it, again, it's the elevator pitch, right? And it's a nice opportunity to, I guess, really reinvigorate what we have and share it out with everybody. So you'll be getting an email, not in violation of Fraud Act, since it's not related to board business, sharing just a little bit more of information. But really, and then finally, thank Darcy, Joseph, Timothy, everybody for the work that has been done in putting this together. Just amazing work. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
All right. Thank you, Joseph.
Okay. All right. Before we go to closed session, it's 6 after. If we could take a 10-minute break, and then we'll head on to conference number 3.
For our interpreters and anyone at our school site, you're welcome to pop off the call at our school sites only if you don't have members of the public. But you won't hear anything for a while because they'll be in closed session for quite some time.
Okay, go ahead.
All right. So we are coming back in open session at 3:59. In closed session, the board took no action as related to existing litigation, but the board reviewed comparable compensation data for KIPP SoCal's chief executive officer, Angela Martinez, and performance from last year. Based on this comprehensive review, the board proposes KIPP SoCal CEO receive a 2% increase. Do I have a motion to approve KIPP SoCal CEO annual compensation to be $358,785 with the standard benefit package available to all KIPP SoCal team members retroactive to July 1st? Julie?
One second.
Heather?
Okay. Okay. Naeem?
Yes.
Carlos?
Yes.
Randy? Mel left at 3:57. Heather?
Yes.
Julie? Luis?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Motion passed. The board also discussed in closed session the appointment of Kyle Saylor as interim CEO. While the current CEO is on intermittent leave along with associated compensation, based on our discussion, the level of responsibilities and the current performance as CFO, the board recommends the interim CEO pay is aligned to KIPP SoCal coverage stipend. Do I have a motion to approve Kyle Saylor as interim CEO effective July 22nd, 2024, and through the duration of the current CEO's intermittent leave with a stipend of... $38,520 or a 15% of the CEO pay grade minimum to be prorated based on the length of time serving in the role.
This Randy, I make a motion.
Okay. Naeem, second.
Naeem?
Yes.
Carlos?
Yes.
Randy? Heather?
Yes.
Julie? Luis?
Yes.
Severin.
Motion passes. Thank you. All right. Unless there's any other questions or comments, I'll adjourn at 4:01. Thank you, everybody.
Great. Forget that one.